Well, it's a great honor to be here on this wonderful occasion. We've heard many great characteristics that Gary has, and I've come to know him over the past few years. And there's this paper that he wrote a couple of years ago, I think, which highlights another great characteristic, which is bold and fearless. Because I think, as Gary has learned, condensed matter physicists can be pretty nasty. And there were quite a few people who were upset by, the bold and fearless claims in this paper. But I can assure you, I defended you strongly. But more seriously, this is actually quite an important paper because it gave condensed matter theorists a different way of thinking about problems they've been thinking about for 15 years. And that whole new perspective has led to very important progress, some of which I'll try to talk about in our work today, somewhat in the same spirit that Rob Myers highlighted in his talk. Although you're solving rather artificial-looking models in using gravitational methods, they are emphasizing an aspect of physics that's very hard to get at from other approaches. And so then it gives you insight on how you could address more realistic problems in the right way. Okay, so that brings me to my talk. So I'm going to talk about transport in strange metals, and I imagine there's many in this audience who, other than the in, have no idea what the other words mean. So please stop me, but I'll try to explain all of that. I should mention that this work I'll talk about today is done in collaboration with actually two very brilliant graduate students I'm fortunate to have, Andy Lucas and Avishkar Patel, and also a former postdoc who's now in the faculty at Cologne. Okay, so here's the outline of the topics I'm going to cover. I'll begin by reviewing actually some very old story of transport in ordinary metals. In fact, it's an argument going back to the early days of quantum mechanics between Bloch and Pyrles. And it actually emphasizes a very important point that turns out to play an important role in modern studies of more complicated metals, like those found in the high-temperature superconductors, where we have to use very different methods, as I'll discuss in the subsequent parts of my talk. Okay, so let's talk about something that's in very basic physics, going back to the work of Bloch in 1930, as you can see. So by that time, we knew that a metal consists of nearly free electrons occupying all the states inside some Fermi surface. We know today that the important excitations are particle and hole excitations across the surface, which behave essentially like free particles. So now if you put a electric field and measure the resistivity, rho of T, as a function of temperature, you would conclude that what you got to do is just figure out how these particles are scattered from external perturbations. And from the rate of scattering, you put that into Boltzmann equation and compute the resistivity. So what Bloch did was implement this idea of these quasi-particles around the Fermi surface scattering off the lattice vibrations. And after a calculation that you can learn about in your solid-state physics course, he found the resistivity went as T to the fifth. And this is actually called Bloch's law, and it's observed in many, many materials, so you conclude the calculation is correct. What many people forgot was that soon after Bloch, but if you actually look up your textbook on solid-state physics, here's my copy, you find that it does mention, to their credit, that this argument is not correct, and it ignores what we call phonon drag, and I'll try to explain what that is in a minute. So this was Pyrles who pointed out in 1932 that Bloch is not correct. And the resistivity actually must be even smaller than T to the fifth at very low temperatures. In fact, practically zero for electrons in a metal scattering off phonons. So today we know that Pyrles is correct, but experiments, well, this is not, this, this is the statement of Ashcroft and Mervyn, although today there are materials where we check that files, that there are deviations from Bloch's law, but Ashcroft and Mervyn say the behavior is not as yet to be observed. So this is another lesson that never believe a condensed matter theorist saying that his theory is correct because it agrees with experiments. That's never a good criterion. Okay, so what more seriously, there's a very important issue here. So why does Bloch work, even though he's not strictly speaking correct, and why does Pyrrhus not work, because although he's correct? So the argument really has to do with conservation of momentum. So you have electrons scattering of phonons, and this is a very weak coupling. The electron-phonon coupling is weak. So there's a slow transfer of momentum from the electrons to the phonons as the current is flowing through the crystal. But no crystal is perfect. There's always some impurities or other defects or perturbations. And so the phonons, once they grab the momentum, very quickly lose their momentum to the defects. So in the end, if you want to figure out how quickly the electrons lose their momentum as they're moving along, really the operational step, the bottleneck, as it were, is the slow process, that one there, and that's what controls the resistivity. So although Bloch didn't worry about the conservation of total momentum, he was correct in not worrying about it, because in real life, the phonons, you know, once an electron loses its momentum to a phonon, you can just forget that momentum. It'll never come back. It's gone and lost to impurities. Okay. But now imagine that we're considering a more strongly coupled system, as you will in strange metals, where the coupling between the electrons and some other boson, some collective excitation, is not weak, but extremely fast. In fact, so fast that these quasi-particles on the Fermi surface are not even well-defined. They become what we call a non-Fermi liquid. So then this process is extremely fast. Any momentum the electron loses to the boson comes right back very quickly. And this, these two systems equilibrate extremely quickly. And of course, Pyrrhus was considering a perfect crystal. And so, you know, he was considering precisely this effect of the conservation of momentum between the phonons and the electrons. So relative to this process, then, any loss of momentum to defects, which are really, really rare in Pyrrhus's mind, is very slow. And so in this picture, then, the resistivity is bottlenecked by the slow process, which is down there, and that's what controls the resistivity. So in a perfect enough crystal, Pyrrhus is correct, but in practice, it's very hard for the electron-phonon system to find such a crystal. On the other hand, if I take some other more, not the electron-phonon system, which we understand very well today, but something with much stronger coupling between electrons and some other collective degrees of freedom, then we would think Pyrrhus is the right way to start, because you can certainly make crystals pure enough that you're just dominated by electron-electron interactions. And certainly in a strange metal, which I just define as a metal which has no well-defined quasi-particles, we should really be working in this limit. And this is precisely the limit that actually Gary's paper was working in. That's where general relativity is important, as I'll discuss. So another thing you see from here is that condensed matter physics have been used for accustomed for the past 25 years, anytime they meet a material, they say, okay, compute the scattering rate of the charge carriers, and that will give you the resistivity. That's like a knee-jerk reaction in every paper. But this shows that this is just wrong. In fact, the resistivity is controlled not in this model, not by how fast the electrons scatter of the bosons. It's controlled by what could be even a neutral boson, anything that carries momentum, whatever carries momentum, neutral or not, how it loses momentum to various defects or any external perturbations. So it may have nothing to do whatsoever with the charge carriers. So that's another very important lesson in strongly coupled systems this time. Okay, so now with that introduction, let's take the Pyrrhus perspective and think about transport and systems in strange metals without quasi-particles. So this is just my definition of what a strange metal is. I'll give you an example of a specific theory that realizes a strange metal. But for now, for the general relativists, just take that as a definition. You have some quantum system which is at finite density. It can transport current, and we're interested in the resistivity. But other than that, we don't know much about it, other than it doesn't have any long-lived excitations that move in straight lines along any direction. No such excitations exist. They just scatter off each other extremely quickly. So there's, so here's an experimental example in this iron nictide. There's this region here as a function of doping and temperature, where the resistivity is approximately linear in temperature. And the cuprates, there's also a more celebrated but similar strange metal region here, where various measurements show you that the assumptions I'm asserting are actually correct. But I'll spare you the details. Okay, so there's been, I think, in the last 5 years or so, including important work by Gary, three different approaches that all starting to come together in describing electrical transport and heat transport and other properties of such of metals without quasi-particle excitations. So these are the, this is what I'm going to use to guideline the rest of my talk, these three pillars. One is sort of a general consequence of conservation laws and local thermal equilibration, that's hydrodynamics, and that, of course, you expect very generally to apply. But the question really is, what are the various terms, what is the temperature dependence and frequency dependence of the various coefficients that go in the hydrodynamic equation that we, of course, know very well? The one way to get at hydrodynamics is to actually start from an explicit microscopic model and then derive hydrodynamics. Now, the way people have traditionally addressed this is by what you would say the Feynman-Kubo religion, where you evaluate Feynman graphs, you invite enough of them, you insert them in the Kubo formula, and out pops transport coefficient. But that's, in practice, extremely hard to implement in strongly coupled systems at finite temperature. There's another approach which actually goes back to physical chemists called the memory matrix approach, which I won't describe. But it's an alternative to the Feynman-Kubo approach, which you can think of it as sort of an RG on the space of operators, which very directly looked at slowly varying operators, slowly varying conserved quantities, which we assume there's a few of them, and in a non-quasi-particle system that we believe is still true. On the other hand, in a system with quasi-particles, we have so many conserved quantities that this is not, the Feynman-Kubo approach is usually superior. So anyway, so that's, again, this is a route that's hard to implement, but we're making a lot of progress and making connection to hydrodynamics. On the other hand, there's this side here where, you know, we have a model that you can solve using holography. We don't quite know what the model is, but it's a model, it's some quantum system which has all these general properties. It has no quasi-particles. It equilibrates very rapidly at finite temperature. It conserves all the right energies. Well, so why not let's study it? And that's, of course, something that Gary has done. And you then learn lots of interesting connections. And some limits, also due to Gary's work, we're trying to close the loop and also understand this connection. Okay, so now let me describe where this framework takes us. So let's first start by something that's analogous to a conformal field theory. So here I'm just saying a theory with particle hole symmetry, meaning, roughly speaking, there's equal number of charge carriers with positive and negative charges. And the advantage of such a theory is that you can have a current flowing with no momentum. So the positive charges flow this way, the negative charges flow this way, and that's a state that carries current but no momentum. And so you don't have to worry so much about the conservation of total momentum conservation, consequences of total momentum conservation. Hyperscaling is a property that, again, something true for all conformal field theories, and it's very briefly, it's a statement of the free energy scales with the dimension of space-time. So for conformal field theory would have dynamic exponent z equals 1, but let's just imagine a more general scaling of space and time. Then from very general arguments, any such theory, its electrical conductivity will have the value which we'll call sigma q, which will go by just general gauge invariance arguments as temperature to the power d minus 2, where d is the spatial dimension, divided by the dynamic exponent z. OK, so this is a very standard result, but it's from the point of view of applying quantum criticality in such ideas to strange metals, it's very disappointing in the sense that if you put D equals 2, this gives you very generally temperature-independent resistance, and that can't possibly explain all the experimental data. So this is a puzzle that's been on my mind for, I don't know, 20 years. But we're now making, I think we're now seeing the outlines of how a solution could emerge. Well, also this has particle hole symmetry, but let's now go ahead and destroy the particle hole symmetry. Then again, from rather general grounds, you can say the conductivity has a general form here. The sigma q that I showed you with particle hole symmetry. And then there's a correction, which is a delta function at zero frequency. This is the Pyrrhus term, if you wish. This is what Pyrrhus was saying, that there is such a term in the electron-phonon problem. And now you can actually even determine the coefficients essentially exactly, and this has been obtained by hydrodynamics, holography, and also by memory functions. And these Q and M are various thermodynamic response functions, which you can easily calculate. They're just static correlation functions. So this is telling you that once you have particle hole asymmetry, then because of the conservation of total momentum, the resistance is zero, meaning the conductivity is infinite at zero frequency. There's a delta function right at zero frequency. Okay, so this is a very general result. There's really no way around it. So to get a finite resistance, you have to stop conserving momentum. So imagine there's some perturbation that leads to a slow decay of momentum on some time scale we've got tau L. So this could be because you have a lattice underlying lattice, and they have so-called Umklapp processes. There could be impurities. In general, anything that breaks the continuous translation invariance of the system. So then you expect the delta function to broaden to a Lorentzian with a half width given by the scattering rate. So that's, again, something you might expect very generally. And in memory functions, you can implement this by taking your original Hamiltonian. This is the one that's translationally invariant, which commutes with the momentum. Then you add a term. This is the lattice potential, let's say, which couples with some operator O. And what the memory function approach tells you then is that this 1 over tau L, the rate you want to compute, is given by some correlation function that's evaluated in H naught in the system without the perturbation, plus some higher order terms. So this is a rather general result, giving you then a temperature-dependent 1 over tau L, which you can now insert in here and then make your prediction. So this is something that, you know, we've been applying to various models with some degree of some progress in connecting to experiments. Okay. So now I've given you then, if you wish, some discussion of this side of this loop. So now let me go to the holographic side. How would you address such questions? So I imagine everyone in this audience is familiar with the ADS-CFT correspondence. Here we think of a CFT as the simplest model of a system of quantum matter without quasi-particles, and is dual to gravity in one higher dimension. But for all these problems here, we have to move away from a CFT by introducing particle hole asymmetry. So you apply a chemical potential on the boundary that gives you some net charge associated with some conserved U1. And in the dual theory, on general grounds, you get an electrically charged black hole, Reisner and Nordstrom being the simplest example. And then by using the same correspondence rules, you can say something about the boundary theory using solutions of Einstein's gravity, Einstein-Maxwell equation, and their extensions in the bulk. So this then gives you really the first solvable model of a system of quantum matter without quasi-particle excitations. That's the power of it, even though it has nothing directly to do with the cuprates. So that brings me to one of Gary's very influential papers, where they took the Reisner-Nordstrom solution and applied to it a lattice potential of H sub L of X, which breaks the translation invariance, and numerically computed by a solution of the Einstein equation, the conductivity. and obtained some temperature dependence of the conductivity, and found that they numerically seem to be in excellent agreement with the memory function expression obtained by Hartnall and Hoffman, which I cited in a previous transparency. Now, very recently, Andy Lucas, my student Andy Lucas has proven what Gary and collaborators did numerically. He's proven for a very large class of metrics that solving the Einstein equation with this metric gives you an expression for this momentum relaxation time, which is identical, you know, precisely equal to what you get from this mysterious memory function approach, which the memory function approach, remind you, is an approach on the quantum theory on the boundary, doing this rather complicated and ad hoc RG on the space of operators, and that gives you in the long time limit something about the relaxation time, and that agrees precisely to what comes out of solving the partial differential equations of gravity in a Reisner Nordstrom background. So and using the fact that there's a horizon and using properties of the horizon. So it's really quite amazing that it all comes together. And now we can close this entire loop, in particular, this connection between holography and memory matrix, first noted by Gary and collaborators. Now we can prove, at least in the weak potential limit, holds exactly. Okay. All right, so then that gives you then, we come back again to the same formula that we can now see comes from hydrodynamics, holography, and memory functions for the transport of electrical charge in a strongly interacting system without quasi-particle excitations. Now, one thing we can do by these same methods, and in fact this can be done by all three methods now, is generalize this without too much more work to an external magnetic field. So what if there's some Lorentz force on these charges as they're moving around, you can figure out what the conductivity sigma xx and sigma xy look like as a function of these same basic parameters. There's no new parameters that appear here that weren't already here other than the magnetic field. So then there was a very interesting paper by Blake and Donos, who argued that if you had a model in which sigma q went as 1 over t and tau l as 1 over t squared, this is the lattice time, both at least in the context of holographic models are reasonable temperature dependences, then the physical resistivity and also what's called the Hall angle have exactly the right temperature dependence that's been observed in the cube rates. And what's significant about this is that this you can argue on very general grounds that this kind of temperature dependence of the resistivity and the Hall angle can't be obtained in any quasi-particle model because there's only one independent quasi-particle scattering rate that determines all of the transport quantities in ordinary metal. So the fact that this can appear so naturally in this more hydrodynamic holographic approach is something that's giving us a lot of confidence that we're on the right track by this very general framework. Okay, how am I doing on time? I guess I have plenty of time. All right, 10, great. So that's a very quick summary, but kind of an overview of where we have gotten through a variety of methods, of which this tool of holography and gravity and Einstein's equations, much to my amazement, something I've been only learning over the last, 8 years, give us a lot of general insight. And now we also are starting to understand exactly what type of condensed matter questions you're able to answer. And the short answer is you're able to discuss systems without quasi-particle excitation in a regime where the local equilibration to local thermal equilibrium is extremely rapid. There is also an almost conserved momentum, at least in the limits we've studied so far. Okay, so then last part of my talk now, we're going to use all these general insights on this three-pronged effort and actually try to make progress on a specific microscopic model. Again, this is a model that's been studied for 20 plus years, but we can bring a whole set of fresh eyes on it and track it in a in a way compatible with what we're learning from the other approaches. So here's a simple model. I mean, I'll be the first to say this is not the model appropriate for the cuprates, because there are many reasons it can't quite apply. But there are extensions of the model which I think one could apply to the cuprates. And it may apply to some of the other materials, like the iron-based superconductors. So the model is very simple. You start with a metal with electrons and some Fermi surface of electrons. And then you imagine that for some reason, some microscopic region, the metal, the lattice electrons, let's say, become an antiferromagnet. So there's a periodic broken symmetry where the spins break spin rotation symmetry and also translational symmetry. So if I looked at the spin expectation value on the lattice sites, there's a field phi, which is going to be my boson now, which varies slowly with space and time, times the e to the ik dot r factor, which accounts for this lattice scale rapid vibration variation. So then as a function of this parameter, you go from a situation where you have this ordinary metal where phi is zero average, and then you break the symmetry where phi condenses, and you have a phase transition to another metal. Now, what's unusual about this phase transition, why it's not something I can just look up in some textbook and figure out all the critical properties, is that while you break the symmetry at exactly the same point, you also change the shape of the Fermi surface. So you have this Fermi surface is a line of zero energy excitation, and the geometry of the line of zero energy excitation reconstruct, as we say, at these points to get what are called pocket Fermi surfaces. And it's that reconstruction of the Fermi surface concomitant with the broken symmetry is what makes this a much harder problem and very different from the kind of relativistic field theories like the Gross-Naveau model that you may quite know, where you don't have these lines of zero energy excitations. So quickly explain why is it that you reconstruct the Fermi surface. If you start with the Fermi surface, and now you translate the Fermi surface by this pi-pi wave vector, then when phi condenses, it mixes the electrons at these intersection points, which are called the hotspots. And then when phi condenses, you open gap at precisely the hotspots. So now if you want to understand the theory of the phase transition, you can zoom in to this point and look at what the theory looks like at low energy, precisely where you're reconstructing the Fermi surface and also you're breaking the symmetry. So if I zoom into that point, this is the kind of low energy continuum theory I get. I get two species of fermions, psi 1, 2, and psi 1 has a zero in a line of zero energy excitations on this line in momentum space. This is kx and ky. So this is not a direct cone, even though it looks kind of like it. Both this direction is not energy, it's kx and ky. And psi 2 has a line of zero energy excitations on the blue line. So there's two lines of zero energy excitations for psi 1 and psi 2. And there's a Yukawa coupling between psi 1, psi 2, and phi, if you wish, right at this hotspot. And so that's the theory. I've said it in words. You can write it down in one line as the action. And now the question is, what happens to this theory right at the critical point? Okay, now one nice thing about this separation of the theory, and this is something that's became evident to us only a couple of years ago, is that it's a very natural connection to precisely this very general formula that we first came across using hydrodynamics and holography. So there were two contributions to the conductivity. One was, if you wish, the conformal the quantum critical conductivity, and the other was the Pyrrhus term. And the way we have set up this theory for this critical point, you see very naturally where these two come from. The particle hole symmetric hotspot theory that I showed you right here, in fact, does not give you a Pyrrhus term because it's particle hole symmetric. So it only gives you directly sigma q. But the rest of the Fermi surface, which I threw out, all these parts of the Fermi surface which are curved, then clearly will contribute to the Pyrrhus term. So you can separate the problem very clearly and do two different calculations, one for this term and one for this term, and then see how it works with experimental data. So that's the program that we have been busily implementing over the last couple of years and making quite a bit of progress in these two terms separately, at least in the cases where you can separate them so clearly as you can for this theory. Okay, but once you get there, you come up with this problem that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk. So now I have this theory here, which is particle hole symmetric. It's strongly coupled. And therefore, if it obeys what we call hyperscaling, then the sigma Q will be temperature independent, and that's a death knell. There's no way that can have anything to do with the real experimental system. Well, anyway, so that's sort of where things stood a couple of years ago, I think, at least in my mind. So one of the things we did a few years ago was look at this theory more carefully, and what we found, one of the things that happens near the critical point is that the Fermi surface acquires this very, acquires a singular shape at the hotspot, where the two Fermi lines become almost parallel to each other, at least close enough to the hotspot. But we weren't able to, however, systematically analyze what would happen at higher orders after this Fermi surface renormalization. The RG flow seemed to just run away. And there was, a real breakthrough from our point of view, work by Shauvik Sur and Sung-Sik Lee just last year, who were able to actually control that RG flow using a novel epsilon expansion. So they dimensionally continued that theory in a very clever way, which I won't describe here, which gave you, all the right properties with the right Fermi surface renormalization, but also a fixed point that at least was controlled for small epsilon. So we went back to this fixed point and have been studying it recently, and this is a paper that we're just writing right now, and we find very happy to find that, in fact, this is the first example of a known field theory which is strongly coupled with particle hole symmetry, but also hyperscaling violation, which is exactly what we wanted. And really, it happens for a very simple reason. It's, again, these gapless lines of zero energy excitation. So when you compute the free energy density of this system, it behaves like a one-dimensional system of the transverse motion in this direction rather than a two-dimensional system. And so there's a violation of hyperscaling exponent theta, which tells you how many dimensions of space-time you've lost. In this case, theta is one. And then you see that sigma Q and other quantities suddenly behave like you want them to behave, at least qualitatively in the right direction. And we can give reasonable arguments for these assumptions of Blake and Donos actually could apply to this model. Okay, so I think that's really all I have to say. I'll just put back this this loop of connections between hydrodynamics, microscopic condensed matter models, field theories that we've been focusing on, and they use the analysis by memory matrix methods, and the solvable models of holography, which are now starting to be intimately connected. So I'm convinced that pretty soon people in condensed matter will have a much more charitable view of this bold paper by Gary.
So I remember when I first started thinking about applying holography to condensed matter.
Yeah.
I mean, I was struck by, why would Einstein-Maxwell theory know anything about like a Drude peak?
Yeah.
And now you tell me your student Lucas has actually proved it. I mean, he's derived that from Einstein-Maxwell?
Well, first of all, getting a delta function, that's something.
Delta function.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you said he's getting the relaxation time.
Right. Not just that there is a relaxation time, but the value of it, which is much more. I mean, the actual value. So what, in other words, there's this expression here. So this particular expression, it's very easy to state the problem. You have some theory H naught, which is a theory without quasi-particles at finite density and conserved momentum, any theory. Now you take that theory and you weakly perturb it by some potential, some operator O, and some perturbation H sub L. So this theory is no longer translation invariant, is going to lose momentum. So what the memory function tells you right away, that the rate at which you lose momentum is just given by this green, this expression. Right. Okay. Now, what Andy has shown, and also some work by others, that you now take this theory, H naught, and assume it as a holographic dual. And in the holographic dual, we just take some very general metric, and Einstein-Maxwell equation and some dilatons to stabilize some theory. And then you take that holographic dual and perturb it also on the boundary. And then you solve all the partial differential equation, do all the asymptotics in the black hole horizon, work out what you get for the momentum relaxation rate. You get some expression. Then you use the inverse of the ADS-CFT expression to get out what that means for the boundary theory. You get this expression, exactly this. So after a rather elaborate solution and asymptotics of Einstein-Maxwell's equation in black hole horizon, you can reproduce exactly this correlation function. So that's, and it was this connection which you noticed first numerically in your paper. Yeah. Yes, yeah, so this to second order in 8-7. Of course, you did it to much higher order, and but I fully expect it holds to all orders. I don't see any reason why it shouldn't. Provided you know, only look at, it'll be some higher correlation functions of O coming in. Well, the memory function, yes, yeah. It depends whether you like, you know, memory functions are approximate methods for obtaining exact results. That's one way to say it. Because they involve a lot of assumptions, but they're very reasonable assumptions. It's not something a mathematician expects as a proof. You make those reasonable assumptions and you get these answers for diffusivities and conductivities, which no one has even proven is finite. I mean, that's a very difficult thing to prove. So you're right. In retrospect, it looks completely obvious. But it took us a while to figure that out.
So very general question from people who are, people like me who are not, who are just vaguely familiar with the ideas, basically. So, I mean, in the beginning, you said this talk was a little bit like Rob Meyer's talk, in which, you know, these are kinds of moral systems which bring out some principles.
Yeah.
What would it take to make it apply to some realistic things? Or what is it? I mean, at very general terms, I mean, you know, it's, what is missing, if like, you know, what is lacking? Why is it not applicable to realistic things? I mean,
well,
celebration of Gary Horovitz. Before I start, let me just say one or two personal remarks. As we've all heard lots of wonderful things about Gary, and I'm not going to repeat them. I'll just agree with them all. But on a personal side, some years ago, I was wondering whether I should leave Princeton and come and direct the ITP. And one of the important considerations in making the decision to come here, a decision that I rarely regret, is the presence in Santa Barbara of an extraordinary group of, at that time, young physicists. In fact, quite bunched in age, starting from the oldest, Joe Polchinski, and then Gary, and then Andy Strominger. And so this was, for me, an enormous attraction. Enormous attraction to come here, and that attraction only increased in magnitude during almost 20 years since I did. Gary is, as you all have said, and will say, is quite a remarkable physicist, and I've grown, my admiration for him has only increased asymptotically. One of the things I admire most of him, which perhaps is obvious in this conference that contains people from Yao to Sachdev, is his passionate sense of curiosity about just about everything in physics, ranging from mathematical relativity to unconventional superconductors, and his versatility in following this curiosity into new fields and becoming a dominant figure in these fields very rapidly. Okay, this session illustrates that very well, since we have talks that range from mathematics to condensed matter physics. And first we have Yao, who was once, employed Gary as a postdoc in mathematics when Gary was doing his important work on energy, positive energy theorems. And Yao is going to talk about quasi-local mass, which I presume has some positivity in general relativity.
Yeah, thanks, David. So indeed, it's an honor to come to give this talk. Gary was my first postdoc. I have